Welcome back to HTP Podcast, where we go beyond just strokes and strategy. Our mission is to change the culture of tennis, having one conversation at a time through a more positive and holistic approach. And if you guys can do me a big favor, I would love for you to subscribe, like, and share, and that would be amazing. And today I have Jared on the podcast. And funny enough, Jared, I actually ran into you. I'll never forget. I was with one of my players, Kate Paulus, in the parking lot at Easter Bowl. And I was just like, hey, you know, I knew at that time I was new to the Arizona area, and I saw you had a license plate from there. So I was like, huh, let me go see. And then, I mean, I ended up working with you, gosh, like three or four years, like a pretty lengthy time.
I actually remember Kate. She was a lefty.
Yeah, Kate.
I want to say she was a really good player, actually. I don't know what she's up to now. She's still playing, but
she got injured and had to stop. But yeah, that's right. That's funny. Good memory. But, Jared, if you could just, you know, really share where you're from, where tennis started for you, and some of the positive, the opportunities that you had with tennis, and some of the negative side or obstacles that you've had with tennis.
Well, I mean, I guess the beginning is a good place to start. I mean, I grew up in New York, and I did not play tennis super early. I was not someone who was given a racket at the age of four. Mostly I played soccer. And then my mom used to drag me to the park with her, and I would probably sometimes hit against the wall. And I wanted to do it lefty. And like when she would try and help me, she didn't know how to help me lefty. So she would put the racket back in my right hand. And I ended up sort of gravitating that way, if only I had known. So I really was fully committed to soccer until I was about 12.
Okay.
Even though I started taking lessons probably around 10 or 11. And then the soccer team, like I was on a club team and like people moved away and it folded. And then I was like, well, I don't have my options for soccer were like much too far away. And I was like, all right, well, like tennis is cool. Like I'll play that. As I started to play more, I remember my first tournament ever. I was like 12 and under. And I played a kid, Luke Lindner, this indoor racket club on Long Island. And I lost the match 0-0. And I think my mom was like terrified. She's like, he's never going to want to play tennis again.
Yeah.
And I didn't know any of the etiquette. After I lost, I went and like grabbed all the balls. And I'm like, God, you're really good. He had like a beard at 12. And after the match, I walked off the court. And then I was like, Mom, I need more lessons. I need to get better. But right away for me, it was like a challenge that I really enjoyed. There was a lot going on. There was like mental components, physical components. And I was like, I want all the information. And I was lucky. I had like a really good coach growing up. And I would do something and he'd be like, all right, like, I want you to do it like this. And I'd be like, well, I don't want to do it like that. I want to do it the way I do it. Why is the way you do it better?
Okay.
And he would be like, he would explain to me like the physics and the time.
Wow.
And I'd be like, all right, well, you presented a good argument. I'll do it your way. And like, if he had just been someone who'd been like, because I say so, or but like, he never would have like gotten past my own like blindness to what was going on.
Yeah.
But he was like always really patient. And then I started, he would do lessons for like 4 or 5 hours.
Okay.
And he'd be like, look, I'll give you a lesson at the beginning and then I want you to stay and you're going to hit with all of the kids after. Okay. He's like, it's helpful for me. And like, sometimes they were really good kids. Sometimes they were bad kids. But like, I was on court and I got to listen to him talk a lot.
Hey.
And so I was like, even at like 14, 15, I was on the court listening to coaching a lot. I think the biggest problem at that age for me was all the things that you miss in high school, like all the parties. Mm. Like back then, no, it was no like online schooling. I basically wasn't going outside of like, you know, 45 minutes to play. I was very local, but there was enough competition sort of where I was.
Yeah.
Every weekend was like a tournament. So every weekend when like, my friends from high school or tennis were doing something, I was like, oh, I can't, I have to go to a tournament. And at the time it feels like a big sacrifice.
Yeah.
Now I look back and tennis has opened so many windows and doors and I've met amazing people and I've been all over the world and I've seen things I never even would have dreamed of. Now the high school parties just don't seem like that much of a sacrifice anymore, even though at the time I understand it's a big deal. So I think one of the things I liked about tennis is that I didn't have the coach subbing me in or out, or, oh, I was having a bad game. In tennis, you get the time to work through the problems.
Yeah.
I like that the match isn't timed. You know, we control time. We can slow down, we can speed up. We have access to do all these different things that in other sports we have to play at like someone else's tempo.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you know, I played in college and then not successfully after for a little bit. And then I had nothing to do with the sport for probably like 10 to 12 years.
Okay.
And I sort of doing corporate work like suit and tie, which didn't suit me at all.
I was about to say, I can't picture you doing corporate work at all.
No, I would say I was a much less happy person
Yeah.
back then. Honestly, when I moved to Arizona, I pretty much thought that was the end of tennis for me. I'd like gone back and done my master's. Physically, I wasn't in great shape. Not like out of shape. I was having like arthritis problems in my hands. And she's like, so I couldn't do much of anything on the court.
Yeah.
So I went back and I did my master's, and then I did post-grad work in hypnosis because I was like, I still wanted to be around the sport, but it was complicated in Arizona because there wasn't a lot of good tennis here.
Yeah.
And this is where I was living. And then just kind of randomly, obviously Bethany was out here and I was like practicing, like I knew her coach at the time. And like sometimes like when you're out there all day, it's like a drag. But if you have someone on like the court next to you and like they're energetic, it's like, oh, I can sort of feed off that energy a little bit. And just I
Absolutely.
think noticing that is part of why I really like to create like a community because tennis is hard. I tell people all the time, I'm like, tennis is hard. If you don't love it, it's not worth it. If you love it, then like, great, this is the right place for you to be. Like, I still love it. I'm on the court like all the time still.
Yeah.
I met Bethany, and as the years went on, relationships changed. And then I started traveling a little bit with her. And once I got a little bit of a taste, and it had probably been 15 years since I had been around the tour from the inside as
Yeah.
opposed to just fan.
Yeah.
It's like so exciting. And I think when I first started with Bethany, they were doing on-court coaching.
Okay.
You know, they would be like, all right, like they beckon you out on court. You've got like 90 seconds. And I remember one of the first tournaments I did with Beth was like after her knee injury, one of the worst sports injuries I've ever seen. We were sort of like practicing a little bit and we would do 15 minutes of mini tennis. We were kicking the can down the road, but only a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
And we started in December. Her goal was maybe to be ready by May for French.
Yeah.
So we were playing a lot on clay, but really kind of casually. As we got closer, I think she realized she wasn't going to be ready for that. And she wanted to come back for Wimbledon, which there was a lot of emotion, I think, attached with that decision. They're like, hey, you really helped get her back to this point. Her old coach, Adam, was on the East Coast. And she was like, can you come to this tournament with me?
Yeah.
And I'm like, sure, I'll come. Like, that
Yeah.
sounds fun. I'll go to, we were going to play Eastbourne,
Okay.
which I hadn't been to. And like, I've done like tournaments here and there with different players, either junior players or pro players. But like, it's different when it's like one-off. And now it was like, I spent like 5 or 6 months. All right, I did my best to get you ready. And like when she got injured, I think she was probably one in the world in doubles and still playing singles. And so when we came back, I was like, oh, this player, she's the best. I don't know if there's anyone out here who could beat her.
Yeah.
And we get there early and I was like, I don't know any of these players. So I just like headed straight for the practice court and I'm like, I'm gonna camp here and I'm gonna watch everybody. And for whatever reason, the first person who I saw practicing was she's still playing now. Her name is Diana Yastremska.
Okay.
She's a young Ukrainian girl who's 5'10", blonde hair. I think it was her mom just like drop feeding balls for her. She was hitting forehands. And I was like, holy shit. She hits the shit out of the ball. I'm watching all these players and I'm like, wow, everybody's really good. This isn't really quite what I was expecting. And honestly, until I started traveling with B, I was someone who really watched almost exclusively men's tennis,
Okay.
which I think is for both men and women, as I work now for the last sort of 10 years almost, or at least much more on the women's side.
Yeah.
A lot of people, men and women, tend to watch the men's tennis. And now I'm a huge proponent of the women's sports. I think it's wildly entertaining. I think they're amazing athletes. So
Yeah.
I remember going back to my room after that first couple of days and watching people practice. And we play tomorrow and we played Srebotnik and Daria Jurak. Srebotnik had been one in the world in doubles and 13 in singles. And I had watched her play and I'm like, shit, it's a tough way to start. Like, former one. And we were originally supposed to play with Danielle Collins, who showed up at midnight the day before. And she had just come from Australia. She had surgery. She says, guys, I can't play. So now we're there. She had no partners. We have to sign in on site with someone. As it turns out, Kirsten Flipkins was there and she's like, I want to play. I knew her a little bit because I had watched. I didn't know her well. So I spent a lot of time that week sort of practicing with her and getting ready. And our first match, they played their first match. And the night before, I'm laying in bed and they're going to call me onto the court at some point in the match. And I was like, I don't know what I have to offer them. I was like, Beth had won seven slams. Flipkins had been top 15 in the world. And I played in college and I've been a fan for a long time. And so I'm kind of like, I don't know what I have to offer at this point. I was freaking out a little bit. The good thing is they showed up that day and they won that match 2-2. They like played lights out. There were a lot of tough teams, like Sabalenka and Mertens were playing together at the time. Simona Halep was playing with Raluca Olaru. There were a couple like sort of tough teams, and I didn't know how good all these teams were at the time. But I'd watched some of them play, and you watch Sabalenka play, and even when she was a little bit younger, she still was hitting the ball big. Maybe we can count on the fact that she'll be out of position. She seemed more of a singles player than a doubles player. But I sort of started to settle in, and I'm like, look, I maybe don't have the same experience, but I have a good eye, and I watch, and I pay attention, and I'm a good problem solver. So, if we're honest about what we're seeing, and we can learn to make the right adjustments, hopefully I can figure out how to be of service. Like, what does the player need, and what is it that I can offer? And that was an intense first week. They ended up making finals. I think we played
That's
Halep and
awesome.
Olaru in the semis and came back from like 8-5 in the third set breaker to win 11-9. We played Chan Chan in the finals. Like, again, like they had been one in the world before Letitia. And it went the other way. Like, we were up in the tiebreaker and then ended up losing it. And for me, a finals at the time, I think it was a 700. So it was pretty good for her to come back after not playing for a year and make finals. She was furious. Like, finals was not a good result for her. So I was like, phew, like finals. I had seen all these players who I didn't realize how good they were. And so I was like, finals, that's a great result. But she was someone who showed up to win and not to do anything else. That was a little bit different for me. It was interesting to sort of like the more time I spent around her, the more I sort of understood sort of like what she was doing and trying to do and looking for. And I think we went, it was only one tune-up. We went and played Wimbledon and she made quarters at Wimbledon where we were playing with Danielle. I think we played Stozer and Shuai Zhang in the first round and they were the fifth seed at the time. So it was a tough first round. They came out and they won that in three sets. We ended up going to the quarters where we played Julie Zhu and Gabby Dabrowski, who were just a very good doubles team. And they figured out, like, Danielle, she was like a great singles player. She was probably top 30 in the world, but they did a really good job of like isolating her and sort of like minimizing how effective Beth could be at the net. So finals and quarters, it was pretty good. I had Otis at home and I was, all right, well, it's over. I guess we go home from here. And then they were like, so there's another tournament in Romania. You ready to come? And I'm like, more? I'm like, okay, let's go to Romania. And we went to Romania. And then from Romania, it was like, hey, we got to go to San Jose. For me, I was just like, even when I went, I was like, I just want to do one tournament. I want to go to Wimbledon. I hadn't been in 20 years. I want to go. And it was so much fun. I just wanted to do one more tournament.
That's
And then like
awesome.
we played San Jose. I can't believe I remember any of this, honestly. We played with Peng Shuai. And she flew in from China literally the day she landed in the morning and showed up on the court. And that was a quick exit. We lost pretty quickly. I think our last tournament of the year was in Moscow, which is sort of funny to think about now because no one, they're not hosting any tournaments. It was one of my favorite cities. It was beautiful and reminded me a little bit of DC, but we made finals there again and lost. I think we won in Beijing. It was a nice year. I think she went from no ranking all the way up to like 23 in the world in like 5 months. And it was like a whirlwind for me. I was like exhausted by the end of the year. I had been gone for much longer than I had expected. And I was really torn between having a young son at home and how exciting it is being out there and trying to balance showing that, hey, you can have a job that's really fun, just because you get older and you work doesn't mean it's the end of the world. Like, you know,
Yeah.
and being there and being present at the same time. So trying to strike that balance. But honestly, like traveling with B and Justin, they happen to be really aware of that. And when I got to go home for a week, they were really good about sort of navigating all the flights and stuff.
Awesome.
That made it easier. And then the more I was out there, the more I'd be like, you know, at the time B was only playing doubles. So I had quite a bit of free time. And then I would use my free time. I would like start to meet people and be like, I started hitting with a few other players and meeting them, and that turned into other things. And now, like 8, 9 years down the road, I've had 7 or 8 tour players, and
that's awesome.
I can't believe how many tournaments that I've had the opportunity to go to. I have some young kids now who are like really exciting. It's funny, the American girl who's out here now, if I'm finishing up, I have this little 12-year-old girl who's, she reminds me a little of Lauren Stein when Lauren was like 12 years old. Feisty, super competitive, but really hits a good ball.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I'll finish up, Robin will come in and I'll be like, hey, just hit with her for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
The little girl, her name is Eloise. Just so you know, you're going to play a tournament. That's not your competition. Over there, that's your competition. That's who you're trying to catch. And just watching a kid be like, oh my God, that part's fun. So, you know, you try and navigate. Tennis is very tough to balance all the different things. Creating a life, being home, having community. Unfortunately, tennis takes place on the road. Like I have a couple of players who are like challengers and some like other WTA events. And they're like, I miss home. I'm like, you don't have a home. Like, your home is on the road. Your home is the next tournament.
Yeah.
Until you're up enough. And this is sort of one of the things. Tennis players make it or don't make it all the time for reasons that have nothing to do with their tennis. Have to do with how well do I navigate the travel, the being away from home, the like being in a foreign country where I don't know the language.
I think that's a really good point. A lot of people, you know, they only see the one side of tennis at the tournaments, but they don't necessarily see all the little nuances that go into making a great team. Like you're saying, the management side, you know, always being on the road. It's like you really have to create your own home and being comfortable away from home so much and really living out of a suitcase.
It's funny, like I see this a little bit more on the women's side than the men's side. One, there's still a lot more money on the men's side. I think one of the biggest myths in tennis is equal prize money. There's not equal prize money.
Yeah.
At the slams, there's equal. And in a couple of the thousands, there's equal. And hopefully they're going in that direction. There's still a lot of pushback for reasons that I think are disingenuous. Part of it is like the guys have more money. They can afford to bring more people.
Okay.
So their teams are a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit easier to create a sense of normalcy because I can say to my buddies or, you know, hey, come on this trip. Like I'll get everything. They get sort of some extra rooms here and there. I don't think it's typically hard for them to like girls and be like, hey, come with to this tournament. Whereas on the women's side, there's less money. So the teams are smaller.
Okay.
It's hard for them to meet people. If they meet really quality guys, typically they have careers and things that they're doing also. So they can't just be like, hey, come on tour with me for a little bit. That's actually not who they're looking to meet anyway.
Yeah.
It is hard for them. Yeah, they're playing tennis and they love what they're doing, but they're also, well, I might one day want to have a family and I might one day want to do these other things.
Yeah.
But I'm not really creating the opportunity to do that part. And it's hard to just focus on work. And then when I'm done, I'll start doing that stuff. A lot of times it's a little bit too long to wait.
Yeah.
So I think having the team around you that allows you to create a sort of sense of a normal life, you know, it's a tennis circus, it's sort of like a traveling circus, but you go from city to city, the better you are at creating a sense of normalcy. We get to this city, we know what we're doing. We get to this city, we know what we're doing. We know, and you have a life. And the more that for the tennis player, all they really have to be worried about is like, all right, I'm going to show up, I'm going to do my practices, I'm going to play my matches, but then I'm going to figure out what it is I like with life. I don't care if you're into fashion or reading or going to museums or...
Yeah, that's a good
point. I think tennis is very hard, but it's also, if you create the right opportunities, it's pretty amazing. One of the hardest things about tennis is also one of my favorite things about tennis.
Okay.
Yeah, the travel is brutal. Going from city to city and being able to, like, I love exploring new cities, seeing museums, going to random restaurants. I know a lot of tennis players who go to the hotel and to the tennis court and they'll be on tour for 10 years.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh my God, you've been everywhere and they've seen nothing. And I'm like, to me, I don't care how much money you made. That's like a huge failure.
Yeah.
And I think it leads to like a a much smaller life and less fulfilling. So
yeah,
even
that's
though
a good point.
sometimes we have a match tomorrow, I got to rest. I don't want to be tired.
Yeah.
First of all, laying in bed is tiring. Sometimes I'm more tired when that's all I do.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's what we're balancing. I'm like, all right, we have a match tomorrow and going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
For 2 or 3 hours is probably a lot of walking and maybe tiring, but that's what we have to do. We have to fit life in, because when we don't fit life in, tennis is just brutal.
Well, yeah, and you get so burnt out too. Like,
so burnt out.
I mean,
there's so many players to me where their happiness rises and falls with whether they win or lose. I understand the stresses that when you lose, you don't make money and you need to make money, especially when you're carrying a big team and you're paying for all the travel and salary. You can have weeks where you actually lose money. You don't make money. You know, you start to pay attention to what money is going out and coming in, and you really have to pick and choose.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it's one of the few sports where in most sports, like in football or basketball, as you coach a higher and higher level, like you're making one thing if you coach like high school basketball, you're making another thing if you coach college basketball.
Yeah.
If you're coaching pro basketball, you're making good money.
Yeah.
In tennis, it's actually sort of the other way. If you're running like a really good junior program,
yeah,
you probably have a million kids on the court and you're making like a good living. If you're coaching, I mean, in coaching in college, you're probably making a decent level. If you're coaching at the pro level, you're like a tennis nut, or if you have a top 10 player, you're making a lot of money.
Yeah.
But like,
there's only
else,
10
like,
of them.
Like, there's not a lot of those jobs available. So for everybody else, the reason we're out there is because we love this sport. At the tournaments, like you say, sort of, I miss that energy. When you go to a tournament, I was at the Open this year.
Yeah.
And you get there and it is so busy and crowded and you're saying hi to a million different people and there's stuff going on and you're like, all right, we got practice here and we got to catch the bus and then we'll go here. And we're trying to fit in so many different things.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, the first day and half the people leave. And then the second day and another half of the people. And all of a sudden it's Wednesday or Thursday and you're like, hey, where did everybody go?
Yeah.
The way the energy changes, when you find yourself there on a weekend and you get on the shuttle to go to the site and or you get in the car and you get there and you go into the lounge where all week you've been seeing people and saying hi to people and now you're the only one in there.
Yeah.
It's like the
That's
catering crew.
Yeah.
And you're here and it feels quiet. They're like starting to take stuff down.
Yeah.
And you're like, hey guys, it's actually not over yet. We're still here.
Yeah.
And it's wild to sort of see that. Obviously it's a good sign when you get to that point, but
I think
those are the,
yeah, I was going to say, I think too, cause I mean, obviously I wasn't at the caliber of what you are talking about with the pros, but playing more at the pro circuit, it's a weird mental feeling of, you're saying, that whole energy of the whole tournament. And as you get to the finals at the level that I played, I wasn't able to travel with a coach. So I have to keep motivating myself over and over to pump myself up. I remember so many times I would call like my coach at the time and tell them, you know, what's going on. They give me some advice, but like, also, can you give me some motivation right now? Because it's like, there's no more energy.
You
have to bring it.
It's so sad to me too, because as a player, you're a remarkable player. You had such a good skill set. And I think under different circumstances, I think you could have made it as a pro when you're out there on your own and you don't even know all the things that you don't know and all the things you're supposed to do. And I'm sure looking back, you could have been like, oh, maybe I could have done this or maybe I could have done that.
Absolutely.
From a skill level, you were good enough. This is what you see. You've been to like big tournaments, but big, like I went to like 18s, like Billie Jean King Nationals.
Yeah.
This year. And it's first day, you're like, oh my God, there's like more people at that tournament than there were parents and family.
Yeah.
We can't get this kind of turnout at like tour event. Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
This is the other part of it, is the top girls, like they're playing on the big stadiums. And that's what we watch when we watch professional tennis.
Yes.
We're like,
watching,
and it feels great. You have people all around all the time.
Yeah.
Except then they call your match and they're like, you know, court 17 and you walk all the way out and you play my first round match. It's you and like maybe there's like four people scattered around and like it's very hard. Like you're playing, you're one of the best athletes in the world at your sport. You have to be able to make it through these moments where it's like, oh my God, what? There's no one out here. I feel like crap. When you have a fan, all these fans cheering you, it's like easy to get up. People would get up for that all the time.
Yeah.
I hate the way tennis is presented. Like the lower level on TV, it always looks empty. You put tennis on a relatively small court, and I would rather a small court that's full than a big court that looks empty, because the energy changes, and then all of a sudden the effort changes on the court, and then all of a sudden the amount of fun changes. People want to be involved. They want to stay there. I don't want to lose. I want to keep going. And you see a lot of times the results are, when people are having a good week, they're like, oh my God, this is my favorite city. I want to make sure that we stay as long as we can in this city. It makes a difference.
Absolutely. I love all this. This is great inside scoop that a lot of people don't see and hear. So I really appreciate that, Jared, with all the ins and outs of tennis, that unless you kind of experienced or been a part of it, most people have no idea. I think that's really amazing. You pointed out a lot of key points as well. If you guys like these tennis tales, please like, share, and subscribe.